You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. It's me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. This is episode 216 of Columbia Calling. I hope you enjoyed last week's show, 215, with Charles Massey, who sang us some Bollywood. And so whoever is on the show today has some big shoes to fill, but he won't have any problem with that because we've got journalist Matt Charles, originally from Lincolnshire in the UK. We've got him on the show. He comes with him with a great deal of editorial wealth. He's worked for The Guardian, for the BBC for over 10 years. And in fact, we got in touch, I think about a year and a half ago via Twitter when he sort of dropped a note saying he was doing something that he couldn't talk about in Colombia, a project. And then latterly, this project came out and it was a sort of documentary series. Matt had been spending some time with paramilitary groups, I would say Bakrim better, the newly emerged criminal gangs, as they're called, or grupos armados organizados, or however you want to refer to them. Anyway, he's been out there in the thick of things. And let me just first say, this is real journalism. I don't even get into this kind of stuff. You know, maybe I scrape here and there, but this is really going out there and getting the story. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that and about how you do this and what it's like and is there any personal risk and everything. But first and foremost, Matt Charles, welcome on Columbia Calling.
Thank you. Please don't ask me to sing.
I won't ask you to sing. You don't have to sing Bollywood. But that's okay. It's like, no, and I didn't try and sing Bollywood, and I really am very unmusical. But anyway, we were in touch, and you were doing this documentary series, short clips about being with the Bakrim, and they got published via Insight Crime, which is a great website, very good for all of the Americas, let's say, organized crime, terrorism, and so on. How is it you came about to decide I'm gonna film about the Bakrim, these newly emerged, well, perhaps in your words, you should explain what the Bakrim are to my listeners.
Bakrim, as I'm sure many people will know, is the acronym for Bandas Criminales, so criminal gangs or bands. But basically, they are the remnants of paramilitary actors that supposedly demobilized between 2003 and 2006. But in many places, these paramilitaries still exist. I mean, academically, a lot of people refer to them as neo-paramilitaries. They are different because they're not just, they incorporate a lot of kind of street urban gangs as well in ways that the paramilitary actors didn't. So they are slightly different actors, but basically it's the same guys.
Yeah.
The guys that had the guns before 2006 have the guns after 2006.
So there's some sort of an element of opportunism in that as well, as you say. They used to be the paramilitaries, they kind of changed their names, they'll work with whomever for financial gain.
Yeah, exactly. They're still involved in the same stuff. They're still trafficking drugs. They're involved in what they call micro trafficking, which is selling drugs to local communities, which is something that paramilitaries didn't necessarily do. It's something that they've done because they've had to find alternative ways of financing themselves because they're not as rich as the paramilitaries were or became. And they have huge extortion rackets where business owners, even nurses and teachers, anyone with a decent salary is forced to hand over a certain percentage of that.
Decent or regular, I would assume. You know, they know you're getting a paycheck every month or every 15 days. So they
turn up and they ask you for whatever you can afford.
So, of course, we've been hit up for protection fees in Montpos.
Really?
But we haven't paid them.
Right, and nothing's happened.
Not yet.
How did they approach you?
Well, they waited for me to be out. And then they came in, and because I think they thought that I wouldn't have been overly concerned as a foreigner, because of course you get that sense of entitlement as a foreigner, and it's a benefit being a foreigner, of course, because you're not under the same, you know, microscope, or you're not under the same glare. So they came up and basically threatened my manager. And this was a few years ago now, I'm not going to lie. And they said, you know, what does the gringo own? He needs to pay for this, he needs to pay for that. And she is a very formidable lady, my manager, because I wasn't there, and afraid, but didn't show it, which was, I think, good. And very cleverly said, the gringo rents the house from a family member, and so he owns the beds, the sheets, the fans. You can charge him on that if you want, but it won't amount to much. And that kind of let it die down. We'll see how it surges once again. But.
Yeah, well, I've heard that kind of similar stories, that they need to know how much you're earning. And if you say you're not earning very much, then they do leave you alone. But they want proof.
Yeah.
They don't just take your word for
it. Yeah, well, of course.
they ask you to hand over books, or they'll
really?
Check. You know, I've heard stories where business owners have had to hand over their accounts, basically, to prove how much they're getting. And they've had to do that monthly. So the extortion rate varies, depends on profit.
So you can follow a graph on it.
Yeah.
Your income increases, their cut will increase.
Yeah, and if their expenses have gone up that month because they've been, they've had difficult operations, or they've been involved in attacks against the police or the guerrilla, then they need more money. So they'll target where they know that, they'll target the businesses they know are more likely to have had more profits. But the thing about extortion, I think, is that it's almost normal in places like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember sitting down in a cafe, you know, just watching the world go by, having a juice, and this guy approached. There are kind of, on the main street in Kaukasia, there are kind of like five or six juice bars all together.
Right.
And people then just kind of sit and mill around and enjoy their drink. And I watched this guy come up, and he was kind of hanging around, which is what drew my eye, because it was kind of a bit suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to one of the juice bars, and then he went to a second one. And that's why I noticed it, because he still didn't have a juice. And I thought, oh, is this guy looking, you know, for his favorite fruit? Nobody has it. But then I saw someone hand over a huge wad of cash, basically.
Mm.
And then he came to the juice bar where I was, and the guy had already been counting it out.
Mm.
He already had it ready, and then just handed it over and gave him a juice as well. And they were chatting, and, you know, and the guy that was asking for the money had his small daughter with him as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's normal. And it's almost like, again, you know, the extortionistas that I've spoken to say that they do this, they're forced into doing it. The guys, you know, the shop owners, the people, the victims that are paying the money know that they're forced into doing it. There's no point in blaming them. But they do know if they don't hand it over, something bad is probably going to happen. So it's just the routine of it is what struck me.
I think that it's so very... it's just routine, normal. The guy can take his daughter along with him. There was no sort of threat levied or anything. There was no feeling of aggression.
No,
interesting, isn't
not
it?
Not at all. I mean, what, again, the extortionists that I've talked to, and the extortionists are at the bottom of the bottom, if you like.
Yeah.
They collect the money, but very close behind them are armed.
Yeah.
Armed
watching,
colleagues,
I'm sure.
Watching and making sure that it. I mean, I didn't see them this day. I couldn't, you know, they're very good at hiding and not being obvious. Mm. But I'm sure they were there, and I'm sure they step in if something, if they need to.
And you know, how much could a juice bar make? How much could you be charging? I mean, it's interesting, you know, someone earning, I would say, very little, and yet still being charged a fortune, really, in their terms. That's pretty hard going. And you were there in Kaukasia. That was for the filming. You were filming there?
I was filming, yeah. The whole investigation is in the Bajocalca region, mm-hmm. which is, well, it's a sub-region of Antioquia. And there are six municipalities.
Yeah.
Kaukasia is the biggest town in the region.
And did you go more inland towards sort of Achi and those areas from Kaukasia and Nechi,
up towards Nechi.
Because these are all places that really have never been, like, let's say, have state presence. I mean, you know, significant state presence. You know, a fast boat might come through, a military plane may fly over, but... Really, there's no one on the ground there.
Completely. I mean, there are small... I mean, the big town's not so much now.
Yeah.
but the smaller kind of villages within the municipalities, I mean, there's no state presence at all. And in fact, the police can't even go in.
Yeah.
Places, I'm thinking, you know, like Piemonte, I'm thinking of, Kuturu, both in the municipal, well, Piemonte is in Cáceres, but Piemonte is a significant place because that is basically their headquarters, the Bakrim's headquarters in this region. And it's accessible really only by water.
And
you can't go in. You can't just wander in. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are armed men there,
right there,
watching you, and they question everybody that goes in. I mean, I went and they let me in, and they let me film for a short while. And I was kind of set up there. Actually, it's a bit of a funny story. It was funny now. It wasn't funny at the time. So I asked if I could go in and film, and they said yes, which was a little bit surprising.
Yes.
But like you said earlier, I think, you know, my gringo face and strange Spanish accent, they find a little bit interesting.
Yeah.
And egos tend to kind of, you know, they're like, oh, who is that? Am I famous? Why is someone from a foreign country interested in me and what we're doing? So they let me in with very strict rules not to go to the right-hand side or straight ahead. Piemonte is kind of divided into three. On the left is where the residents live.
Okay.
Straight ahead was kind of access to the mines, and I'm assuming where the laboratories are, where they make the cocaine. And to the right was the nicer houses where they live and hang out.
Okay.
So I went to the left. I had an escort. I was filming, wanted to talk to people. Obviously, nobody would say anything. And plus, I had an escort with me anyway, so you know, if they'd have said anything, they'd have been in trouble. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't a pointless exercise because it was interesting to see this place. And we can talk about what happens there later, because I have talked to residents that live there. Mm-hmm. And it started to rain, but rain really, really badly. And actually, it broke my camera.
Uh-huh.
And the camera, I haven't, you know, it's not, I haven't been able to repair it. So, you know, these images are very precious to me because it ruined the camera. And it was raining and it was soaking wet. And I was shivering. And on the right-hand side, where I was not supposed to go, was where there was a little cafe with very hot chocolate and, you know, steam coming from these cups. And I was kind of looking at them thinking, shall I or shan't I go over there? And the guys that were over there beckoned me over and said, no, it's fine, come over.
Really?
So went over, and just as they were about to serve this coffee, three or four guys appeared with machetes and said it was time for me to leave, and basically ushered me onto the little boat that took me back across the river. So that was my short visit to Piemonte.
And the images?
The images are good
until
the moment that it all goes fuzzy and black and
Now, I mean, so this was, I mean, this was something I was going to explore a bit later as we wind down this first section of the show. I mean, there was a significant risk to your well-being. Three guys coming out with machetes, they didn't like brandish them above you or anything. They just said they sort of had them hung down by their sides. It's time to go.
Yeah, and they had guns as well.
Yeah, of course.
And they just, you know, it's time to go. And the one really interesting thing about paramilitaries is they don't look you in the eye.
Really?
And I don't know if it's because you're not worthy.
Uh-huh.
They will only talk to the people that they know, you know, as conocidos.
Yeah.
So I would always go to these places with someone that was known to them. I wouldn't just wander in. But they would always, you know, I would be with on the back of a motorbike with a mototaxista, and they would always talk to them and not to me.
And so it's a lot like, does he know what he's doing? Does he speak Spanish? Or were you always...
Yeah, and
like,
they would ask questions to me, but via the person, even though they realised that I did speak Spanish and could answer for myself. And even when I did answer myself, they would very rarely look at me, and I always thought that was strange.
Now, I have to ask you this, because that's given me another question. Again, this is right at the very end of this first segment. I went down to one of these transitional zones in Guaviare last year, which is one of, you know, phenomenal experience, and sit down. And as I was going in with my friends from the UN and from Gestión de Riesgos and all of this stuff, they were like, look everyone in the eye. With the FARC, you had to look everyone in the eye, which is completely different to what you're saying. So very interesting. Has that been your experience as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of training that you do as a journalist for hostile environments will teach you that. Always look people in the eye. But that was why it's so weird that they didn't want to look at me. And you feel rude almost trying to force them to look at you.
Yeah.
And I think that was probably not the best tactic. Mm. But I think it's also them, you know, it's the way of keeping the barrier there. It's very macho, this bravado, you know, I'm tough, I'm so tough that I don't need to look at you.
Maybe. It's curious, though, isn't it? It's interesting that I'm sure that that barrier thing you're saying, I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. And it equally, if they don't look you in the eye, surely it dehumanizes you. You know, you are not an individual. You're just an object who's there, which would then make whatever repercussion that might occur easier to do. You haven't made small talk and told them about your family, told them about your life, your football team. You know, it's it sounds banal and trivial, but there's a truth to it there.
Yeah.
I think
is
fascinating.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, fascinating to be talking to you, Matt. I'm really glad that we finally got together and have been able to talk about this. So we're going to take a short break here on Columbia Calling. This is episode 216. We're talking to Matt Charles, a journalist from the UK with a wealth of knowledge of Columbia. And yes, I've done some really out there interviews, recording and articles. Check him out. He's been on the BBC, The Guardian and Insight Crime, amongst other places. And we'll be back in a short, in just a few minutes, and continue this chat about Columbia, about what's going on at the moment, really. So don't go away. Thank you again. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, episode 216 with Matt Charles. We're here enjoying some inclement weather here in Bogota. But we're talking about Matt's investigations and recordings and articles and everything that he's done in Colombia over the last year and a half, and obviously longer than that. And we've been talking about how he ended up in, you know, recording. Well, let's say recording and taking photographs and writing articles about the Bakrim. But I want to ask, from a journalist's point of view, is like, you know, I don't get permission from my Santanderiana wife to go to these places. But I want to ask, from a journalist's point of view, how do you get permission from the Bakrim themselves to end up, like when you go to Piemonte, someone in Caucasia had to obviously give them the word and spread it on. And it's like, there has to be a chain of command, right? So how do you get in touch with them?
Well, it takes a long time. Mm-hmm. Well, it did for me, and I think that's important because you have to, you know, show that you are genuine. Mm-hmm. And build trust is the important thing. And basically the way I did it was get to know the locals in Caucasia first.
So you spent a good amount of time in Caucasia.
This investigation basically took 3 years.
Wow.
It spanned 3 years, and Once you get access to one of them, I mean, I've called it the snowball effect, because then they say, well, talk to my mate, and then you suddenly have access to, you know, the whole group, which is great. I mean, always with someone that they know. So I was very lucky, really, that one of the regular mototaxistas that I worked with ended up, I mean, he didn't tell me this to begin with, but after the first two or three trips there, I would always work with him because he was a nice guy. Yeah. I trusted him. He seemed to know the area. And then he told me that he was a demobilized paramilitary.
Oh.
So I was like, okay. And he knew, basically, he knew them still very well. Mm-hmm. He'd had an accident, which was, because I was a bit suspicious. I was like, once you're a paramilitary, always a paramilitary, really. You can't leave because they kill you in case you start, you know, informal. So I was a bit suspicious, but it turns out that he'd had an accident and had quite a serious head injury and had brain surgery.
Oh, really?
So I think that's why they kind of left him alone. That's what he said anyway. So, but it was through him. Then he introduced me to one sicario, a hitman, who explained, you know, how that whole process works. And the most shocking thing about that is how little life costs, really. And for, you know, 200,000 pesos, 200,000 pesos, which is what, like 80 pounds
or
less?
Yeah, 80 pounds or less.
Someone will kill you, you know, someone will kill. And that's, you know, that's quite shocking. I mean, in these places, that is a lot of money.
And the minimum, legal minimum wage is just over 700,000 pesos, yeah. right? So yeah. put it into context as well. So, I mean, yeah. it's...
yeah. yeah. Wow. So it's shocking. And then from there, you know, then we met an extorsionista, so a guy that was collecting extortion from businesses, people. Mm-hmm. They have set amounts for that as mm-hmm. well sometimes. We were talking before about percentages, but they do have set. So it's 10,000 per cow, for example, mm-hmm. if you own cattle. He used to collect from slot machines. So again, it was 10,000 pesos, about £3 from
really?
to collect from each slot machine. And then basically gradually made my way up the food chain, as it were, mm-hmm. To speak to commanders.
Yeah. And speaking to these commanders, I mean, were you nervous or just the adrenaline take over?
I was nervous, I'm not going to lie. But you can't, you know, I don't concentrate on that. You can't mm-hmm. concentrate on that because that's when they start to realize you're nervous. And if mm-hmm. you're nervous, it makes them nervous. And if they're nervous, mm-hmm. You know, their finger is on the trigger.
and when you talk to these commanders, I mean, do they treat you cordially? They invite you in, you know, invite you to have a sip of rum or aguardiente with them? Or is it very businesslike?
Both. Yeah. I mean, some were very friendly and, you know, will enjoy a drink. But, you know, others were quite cold. Mm-hmm. And actually, I suppose that the further up the food chain you went, or the more responsibility that they had, mm. or more experience, I guess, they were cold. And I think that was suspicious.
Yeah. You know?
They do want to know what you're doing there, why you're interested in that. Mm-hmm. And journalists are not their best. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Journalists are not their best friends. Mm-hmm. And they think, you know, journalists are out to kind of get them. They equate journalism with the state, with, you know, mm-hmm. with the security forces. Mm-hmm. And I think once you can prove to them that you're not interested in pursuing justice or bringing them to justice, because mm-hmm. that is not the job of a journalist, then they kind of start to warm to you. Mm. And especially if you've known someone that they know. That was always key.
Yeah.
You know, it was never cold. It was always, okay, so you've been talking to X, and so you must be a decent guy.
So you'd presumably say as well when you came in, so X told me that you'd see me, I spoke to him however many days ago.
Yeah, well, again, you have to be careful with that, because I never told them what someone had said, because I didn't want to drop them in it. And, you know, there's always a lot of infighting in these gangs.
Yeah.
And it, with the Inside Crime investigation, I think there are 5 video interviews. Mm-hmm. 3 of those are now dead.
Really? And these are not commanders. These are sicarios.
No, they were arraigned. Yeah, one of them is a commander. Was
really?
Former head of finance for the whole zone. And that was interesting. The stuff that he revealed, mm-hmm. how they, so the money from micro trafficking, so the money from selling drugs within the local community, they spend on legal fees and parties.
Oh, really?
So that money they keep for them. Extortion basically pays the wages, mm-hmm. And then it's drug trafficking and mining that bring in the big bucks.
Yeah, I mean, the mining, the cut from illegal mining, or illegal mining, I think, as well, and drug trafficking. So I did hate to sort of dwell on this. This guy, the guy head of finance, he's been assassinated.
No, he hasn't. He's still alive.
Okay, so the guy who was killed, though, you said one of the, for what reason?
For informing, basically, because he was working with the army.
Oh, really? So he was a double agent then, basically, as you say. Yeah, that would bring your life to a short end.
And he was actually, I'm not going to say which one, but he was murdered by one of the other sources.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Ah.
So it was a difficult. I was kind of caught in the middle, really, because I knew stuff was going on. You just have to remain as neutral as you can and stick to the job that you're doing.
Yeah.
But that's why it's important not to say he said, she said.
Yes.
Because, you know.
Yes, I can understand that. Now, these groups, I mean, the groups that you've been looking at in the Bajo Cauca, and I think we can agree that the Gaitanistas, which is reasonably new, but they've sort of evolved from other groups, and then we've got the Oficina de Envigado, which is a very Medellin-based one, and I know that their tentacles grew right to the very top in Medellin, especially even to hotels. And then I believe there's a local group also involved. How does this work? I mean, how with these three groups jostling for control? Is there an internal war now?
Or? Well, what's happening in the Bajo Cauca? The paramilitary is demobilized. Mm. The paramilitary that kind of rearmed, if you like, mm-hmm. And formed his own backroom group there, known as Los Chepes. Mm-hmm. This gang has always been local. Mm-hmm. So this gang has controlled the Bajo Cauca since the two dominant paramilitary groups there officially demobilized. Mm-hmm. This group they call Los Chepes, but they are affiliated to the Orobeños.
So another group. Yeah.
Another group, yeah. Which, you know, the Orobeños is the nationwide group, mm-hmm. if you like, even though it runs on a franchise model. But the Bajo Cauca is probably one of the areas where the Orobeños group or the cell there is very autonomous. Mm-hmm. So again, I was told that Los Chepes would pay Los Orobeños a tax each month to keep their zone, if you mm-hmm. like. But also the Orobeños would, moving the shipments of drugs through there, would pay per shipment as well. So there's a really interesting, because you think one would cancel out the other, mm-hmm. but there is a really interesting handling of cash going on. And what's happened in the Bajo Cauca is that the local gang, to be honest, there's been very successful police operations over the past couple of years. Mm-hmm. And gradually, the dominant figures have been captured mm-hmm. or killed. The most recent and the most significant, I think, is someone called Alias Seisiete, mm-hmm. who was captured in Medellin. But he was the kind of big commander of the zone, if you like. And once he went, there was a lot of infighting.
So a vacuum of...
A power vacuum. And the Orobeños are kind of a little bit fed up of having to always send new people in to take control of this zone. And I think they've just decided that basically we're going to take this back for ourselves.
Oh, really?
And the Oficina, a couple of groups, because again, the Oficina is a kind of autonomous model mm-hmm. of other gangs. A couple of those are reported to be trying to make a play for the Bajo Cauca as well, because they see the local group as being particularly vulnerable, particularly mm-hmm. weak. So right. Just recently in the past week, the murder rate there has shot through the roof.
Really?
I mean, there's been, you know, five or six murders a day, apparently, because of this fight.
And your contacts, they call you and tell you these things?
Yeah, they tell me, and paramilitias regularly issue panfletos, you know, a way of communicating with the local population. And there have been mm-hmm. a few of those circulating, saying, you know, stay at home because mm-hmm. we're going to fight until we, win,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah.
So it's been pretty violent.
Really?
Again.
So to tell us then why this region is so key for these groups or for any group. Why is this region? I mean, I think of, obviously geographically, the route from Urabá, so that gulf up by, you know, between Panama and basically Colombia's Caribbean coast, and then the sort of lower Cauca and the growing regions and access to the Pacific, I assume. But what more can you tell us about this region?
Well, I think it's because it's a junction, really. Mm. It's an access. You can get to the Pacific and to the Atlantic mm-hmm. from there. And I think that's basically the important aspect of it. Plus, there are a lot of mines there. Mm-hmm. It's a region that's very rich in gold, and again, massive coca growing.
Yeah.
So it is a valuable territory for them, and always has been.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I mean, yes, because I know. I mean, obviously, from my knowledge of the other side and of the, let's say the Cauca and Magdalena rivers, and then my wife's family is from her father's family is from Morales and all of that very very disputed region, ELN and various other armed groups. You've just written a piece, let's say recently, a few weeks ago, for The Guardian about the ELN, so you were out with them as well. So you jump out of one frying pan into, I would say, another frying pan. How did you, again, through various channels, you managed to get hook up with this the remaining guerrilla group in the country, and they said, yes, come on out? So it's like...
Yeah, I think, I mean, over the past couple of months, many journalists, I think, have visited the ELN, and I think it's because they've opened up their ranks, if you like, to try and get their point across during the peace negotiations and during the ceasefire. They felt that, especially the Colombian media, was not representing their view or their ideas fairly, and so I think, or accurately, let's say. And so they opened up because they felt they had a message to get across. And so, you know, I wasn't the only one. I think I was one of several that were let in and, you know, that they hosted, let's say. But yeah, to be honest, I found that I was much more scared of the ELN than
really?
The paramilitary.
Interesting. That's interesting.
But don't ask me why. I don't know. I think,
but it has to be an ambience that puts you ill at ease. Or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's because I hadn't really encountered them before. Oh. I was stopped once in the Chi by the FARC, and I think it's just because I hadn't really encountered them. And most Colombians will say that the ELN are the most you know, the bloodthirsty, if you like. They will quite easily kill and of course kidnap foreign journalists. And I never felt as a journalist that the paramilitary would ever do anything like that. Unless I publish something that massive expose on who they are and what they, what they get up to.
Talk about that. I mean, I'm sure you went through a fair bit of self censorship when you did your stuff on the paramilitaries and, let's say, the back rooms. There are things that you've left out.
There are things that I've left out, but not for my own safety.
Okay.
Things I've
for
left
the safety
out
of others.
For the safety of others. Yeah. Yeah.
And so tell us about, if you go down and spend, I mean, how long did you spend with the ELN then?
5 days.
In the Chocó?
In Chocó, in the Medio San Juan.
Oh, really? I mean, you had to hike out, I assume. You get off somewhere like Cartago and then hike or something?
No, the journey was, I mean, it took, because it was Christmas, I mean, there were no flights, no buses. You know what Colombia's like at Christmas time.
Yeah.
It was insane. So the whole journey, I mean, it took me longer than, I think it took me like 25, 26 hours. To get there, so I went to Quibdó on a bus from Bogotá.
Good.
Quibdó to Ismina.
Yeah.
And then on a boat.
Right.
To a place called Nuamaná.
Okay.
Which is a town on the banks of the river.
It's caseríos on those little towns. Yeah.
And then from there,
hike.
Well, another 6 hour boat ride.
Wow.
Basically.
I mean, it's really far in. I mean, you're at their mercy.
Yeah, so you can't. Yeah, once you're there, there's no going back.
And so to tell us about, I mean, how do they tell it? I mean, I'm sure it's for me, it's fascinating. But they give you your own campsite. Do they feed you the 3 meals a day? I mean, what
they did. They did feed us. Not always 3 times a day, but there was food available.
Okay.
And
was it begrudgingly, you know, toss an enamel plate at you?
It was, to be honest, because there was a lot of there's a lot more distrust among their rank and file. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of suspicion about journalists and journalism. But it wasn't a camp per se. What the ELN do is they kind of roam the jungle and temporarily occupy the villages in the jungle. So this was a village with, you know, people's houses.
Yeah.
And 100 ELN rebels that just take over and,
really?
And sleep in people's houses, as did I. You know, someone very kindly gave me their floor for a week. And they take over the place. And the relationship between the ELN and the community, I thought, was quite interesting. And I wanted to really kind of talk to the community and find out how they felt about it. But it was really, really hard because nobody wanted to talk. Not with the ELN there. I had to go to other places to kind of get a real picture of it. I mean, there's a lot of support for the ELN, but one guy told me, and I thought this quote kind of sums up perfectly, really. He says, "We support them as much as we fear them."
Yep.
And I thought that was quite telling.
Wow! I mean, that's so. You're on the floor in a hut in the jungle. Yeah, 5 days. And
being eaten by mosquitoes.
Oh, I'm sure you were being eaten by everything out there. But, and then tell me something about, because we've had in the last week or so, you know, there's been all sorts of trouble with the ELN. A new ceasefire has failed to be agreed upon. The ELN have ramped up their attacks, blowing up the Canyon Limon pipeline in various parts, injured some soldiers, and basically done stuff to, you know, force the government's hand, show them that they, you know, they are I've got the upper hand in the negotiations, these long negotiations that are going on at the moment in Quito. Well, they're not going on at the moment. They're just sort of suspended at the moment. Now, various people in the know have said that these are divisions within the ELN themselves, that the central, let's say, secretariat or whatever they call themselves, the 12 person or whoever they are, Gabino and those guys, and Pablo Beltran, are not in control of, let's say, the group that's in charge of the Saravena Arauca area. Is this something that you've heard or seen? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's something you hear a lot, and the ELN, you know, again, it's autonomous. The 8 fronts of the ELN have their own command structures and their own influence and their own power. And the group in Arauca, like the group in Chocó, are supposedly the two most autonomous and the two most violent and certainly the two most criminally involved, let's say.
And most economically viable, I would imagine.
Exactly. And that's what some say give them the power. So I was with the Western War Front in Chocó, and they denied that there's any differences. Their commander denied that there's any you know, that they're going to go rogue. But they certainly could if they wanted to. And I didn't really get the sense that was an honest answer. I felt that this was the idea that they were trying to project at the time, that the ELN is united. But the violence since the end of the ceasefire is not a mistake. It's not, you know, this will be coordinated and but it's interesting that these two groups could have an influence on the central command because the ELN's wealth comes predominantly from them and their illegal activities.
That's it. I mean, it's strategic. I've always said, even 11 years ago, you know, the FARC might have the numbers, but the ELN have the positions. There's these strategic positions where infrastructure, where smuggling, you know, contraband, everything, you can really move so much with such ease. So therefore, income is never going to be a problem, and especially like Norte Santander as well. I mean, you know, they could just. I've seen images and stuff, and I know these towns like Pelaya and all this stuff along the Pan American Highway. The ELN could just drop down in the night, attack a military post or a police station, and go away. You know, and no one knows any better. It's like they are so well positioned. Dug in, basically.
Exactly, and in Chocó. What's happening there is they could be getting even richer, if you like, because of the vacuum left by the FARC. And that's why there have been many, you know, clashes in Chocó with the paramilitaries there, because they're fighting to take over the control that FARC had of the area's drug production. So that their stake in the drugs market is increasing.
Now, are the ELN, in your knowledge, are they moving into places, other coca-growing areas like Putumayo and into these areas that have been left by the FARC?
Certainly in Chocó, there. So in the kind of Bajo San Juan, there are very, you know, there's regular clashes. Mm-hmm. And again, in the north of Chocó, there are very regular clashes between the ELN and the paramilitaries. And you know, the local communities there are caught in the crossfire. And I met some of them, and they will say, you know, they don't really care about the ceasefire with the government because it doesn't impact on them, because operations and clashes with the paramilitaries were still continuing anyway. And they were caught in the middle.
Hey, and so it doesn't bode very well for Colombia in this year, 2018 presidential elections. And in a nutshell, how do you feel that the country's going to come forward or pull through this? Can it? President Santos has an approval rating that, you know, but anywhere between 20% and 25%, I think. The peace dialogues, let's say, with the ELN are suspended. The government seems to deny paramilitary groups exist. They prefer to change the names because I think that that facilitates government action. I mean, these areas in the far off and beyond in Colombia, which have really never had any state presence, will continue not to have any state presence. I don't see, for example, the Bajo San Juan getting any better. I don't see Caucasia, which I know very, very superficially, getting any better. I mean, how do you, as someone who knows it on the ground, see it?
I mean, I'm not optimistic at all. I mean, I think, you know, Colombia's had this massive rush to peace, which is amazing and it's fantastic. But I'm not sure it was fully prepared for the vacuum that this has left behind for communities like the Bajo San Juan and communities in the Bajo Cauca. Peace means very little at the moment, and it's again, you know, talking to them, they in the Bajo San Juan, I think they voted for 96% in favor in the referendum in 2016. And now look at them.
Yeah.
What does peace mean to them?
Yeah.
And you said, you know, a lot will depend on the election. And you said, you know, these places are basically being forgotten, and it will probably get worse before it gets better.
And I think this is something you brought up just now. You know, these guys voted for it 90-whatever%. The places that have been strafed by the violence voted in favor. You know, it's not the nice urban, nice, you know, rural place. These are the real, I don't want to say ground zero, but the epicenters of the violence are the ones who voted in favor of peace and now are living in the worst possible situation as this vacuum. I kind of see it as sort of all these balls in the air just waiting to settle, you know, and then once they settle and the people, you know, okay, the dominant force takes over, their lives will improve, maybe. You know, there won't be crossfire.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're still in this transition period that will probably last several years and will depend very much on who wins the election and you know, on what happens there. But, yeah, I mean, you know, peace is a big word.
Yeah.
But are we there yet? Not quite.
I mean, we're running out of time, but we need to mention that, you know, these recordings that you made with the Bakrims are going to be part of a larger documentary project, which will in turn be made into a video game. Just give us a synopsis of this.
Yeah, so there'll be a traditional documentary, but also a video game as a documentary where the player basically is a journalist investigating the Bakrim and... we'll use some of this, you know, the real footage that I did and face some of the ethical and logistical dilemmas that I faced. And this is all being placed in a kind of a world. It's all set in the Bajo Cauca, but it's a combination of fact and fiction, you know, to basically raise awareness of the challenges of post-conflict, but in a tastefully entertaining way.
This is not doom, you know. We're not looking at you know, something intentionally gory or
it's
cerebral, let's say.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And you can't name them, I know this, but big companies are looking at it.
Yeah, it's so the whole project, you know, talking to some big broadcasters about, you know, handing over the dough basically to finish the project. So
well, promise me, because it will come out, and I believe genuinely in that, once it's out and once it's a roaring success, you'll be back on Columbia Calling and tell us further about it and the whole process. You know, this is another way of getting information out there. I mean, people don't, let's say, watch TV like they did before. You know, as I was saying, the millennials don't spend money on cable. They pay their Netflix, they watch the internet. You know, and I'm sure computer games is another way. So something else to investigate on another show, because it's a huge issue. But let me just say thank you.
Thank you,
Matt Charles, for being on Columbia Calling, this episode 216. It's been really interesting. And
thank you.
I'm absolutely certain we haven't got you in trouble. I didn't make any you know, untoward questions that's implicating anything, but keep doing what you're doing. You know, the mainstream, like Guardian, Inside Crime, the BBC, they need
people like you to continue to give high quality products so they feel like, you know, they can't not print it or broadcast it. That's the truth. I mean, that's the truth. Otherwise, the news doesn't get out there. Because it's harder and harder these days to sell, unless it's the spirit of Chavez, from Venezuela.
Well, I mean, the situation here is so complex. Yeah. It's hard to sell, and there's, I don't think there is a proper understanding from the international media community of what's actually happening in Colombia.
No, this is true. This is true. Otherwise, we'd all be writing nice. nice travel pieces and real estate fluff for all of those reality TV shows, relocation and stuff like that. Anyway, thank you again. Me signing off. I've been Richard McCall speaking to Matt Childs. Of course, on the Facebook page we'll have links to a couple of the documentaries up there so that you can see them and click on them yourselves. This has been episode 216. It's been fascinating, real editorial strength here. And again, next week we'll have someone else interesting on the show and continue to try and spread news, either good or bad, but news about Colombia. Thank you again. Bye-bye.